Hello, I'm Wendy Barrett Stewart. This is number 0577, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0577. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a return visit from Nick Santora. He's the executive producer of the short-form Quibi series reboot of The Fugitive, starring Kiefer Sutherland. If you put all the episodes, which are under 10 minutes, together, could it be a full movie?
If you put it all together, it will play like a really interesting, engaging film. And it'll run like a film will run, with a first act, second act, and third act, and take you on a fun journey, a little bit of escapism, a little bit of fun, and that's the goal. And when it's all said and done, you can take these Quibi series and edit them and turn them into a film. And that's what we're going to do with The Fugitive, and that's what we're in the process of doing with Most Dangerous Game, the other Quibi series I did with Christoph Waltz and Liam Hemsworth.
Dan Peraro, the creator of the Bizarro comic strip, has written a graphic novel called Peyote Cowboy that you can read online for free.
It's really going to be posted serially. You have to sort of follow it week by week. The illustrations are elaborate. The story is big. There's a lot of characters. A lot of things happen. There's double backs. There's twists and turns. So illustrating all of that, it's pretty hard to anticipate or estimate exactly how long it's going to take me to illustrate it.
Mark Hartzman is back on the show. He has a website called weirdhistorian.com, and each month he'll be here to feature an odd historical fact for the month, such as the New York Straw Hat Riots of 1922, where kids would steal men's hats right off of their heads.
After September 15th, it was a fashion faux pas. You weren't supposed to wear your straw hat anymore. You had to switch over to your felt hat. And if they didn't, kids would just swipe them off your head and smash your hat. On September 16th, it was reported that a whole bunch of these kids in New York City, they would hide between the doorways and they would have sticks with hooks on them at the end, and they'd snatch hats right off the heads of people walking by, and they would just start stomping on them. They would put them in piles and hold bonfires in the streets. And this was like thousands of people's hats were just being taken and stomped on.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0577, was Wendy Barrett Stewart, who is a cat rescuer. Yes, I mentioned a cat rescuer. She runs Cats Manger Rescue. You can check out her Facebook link, which you'll find on our website for this show, which you just heard Wendy mention. See how that all goes around full circle? Wendy is a sweetheart of a gal whom I went to college with back in the day. How sweet is she? Well, she just got me to say something positive about cats. You know, this is a rare moment. Thank you very much, Wendy, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, the release of this show at press time comes out to herald in a new week, which means the end of a long weekend. I hope all, no matter where you are, who hear the sound of my voice have survived the long weekend. It's okay to take holiday from all of your troubles and to leave reality behind, but that doesn't mean you should leave safety behind. It's anticipated that the Labor Day weekend will herald in yet another coronavirus surge in the U.S. Hotspots in the U.S. saw jumps in the deadly virus after Memorial Day and the 4th of July. So, let's keep in touch for a couple of weeks from now to see what springs up in America. Because, you know, only those who saw the 1934 Frederick March film Death Takes a Holiday and believe it was a documentary are the ones who believe they are immune from the pandemic.
His Majesty Death, amusing himself on a holiday, amusing himself with love.
Love indeed. By the way, many Americans often come up to Canada for Labor Day weekend, even though we spell it with a U. But sorry, we're closed. 29-year-old Sabrina Belcher told police that she was beaten and kidnapped by a strange man and her car windows were broken. She was taken to the hospital. Christopher Eddy was arrested in connection with the incident, and so was Belcher. The two are accused of conspiring to fake the attack, which police describe as a Facebook Live stunt to win publicity, sympathy, and votes. Belcher is running for mayor of Sumter, South Carolina. Well, now she has lots of publicity. I hope they allow mail-in ballots in jail. A woman and her pot-bellied pig were booted off a Washington, D.C.-bound plane after passengers complained the pig was disruptive and stinky. The pig, thought to be about 70 pounds, had been brought aboard a U.S. Airways plane at Bradley International Airport in Connecticut as an emotional support animal. Crew members determined the animal was too disruptive and asked the woman to leave with the pig before the flight departed. Some people aboard the plane thought the woman was carrying a large duffel bag over her shoulder, but it turns out it wasn't a duffel bag, said passenger Jonathan Skolnick. We could smell it, and it was a pig on a leash. She tethered it to the armrest next to me and started to deal with her stuff, but the pig was walking back and forth. Okay, in all seriousness, what clown at the gate even allowed this woman to board a plane with a 70-pound pig? I mean, really? This brings new meaning to swine flu. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an American Airlines pilot preparing to land in Los Angeles reported an unusual encounter. A guy in a jetpack.
A Tower, American 1997. We just passed a guy in a jetpack.
American 1997, okay. Thank you. Were they off to your left side or right side?
Off the left side, maybe 300 yards or so, about our altitude.
That altitude was at 3,000 feet. The pilot said the Buzz Lightyear wannabe was about 10 miles away from the airport and came within 300 yards of the plane. A second pilot also reported spotting Jetpack Boy.
Skywest 3962, and we just saw the guy pass by us at Jetpack.
The second sighting forced air traffic control to then warn all other aircraft in the busy LAX corridor.
JetBlue 23, use caution. Person in a jetpack reported 300 yards south of the LA final at about 3,000 feet, 10-mile final.
JetBlue 23, we're heard. You're definitely looking.
The jetpack sighting remained a mystery as no one had come forward to claim credit for the flight. The Federal Aviation Administration said the investigation into the incident has been turned over to the Los Angeles Police Department, and the FBI also has some questions. They've opened an investigation, too. Well, say what you will, it's a dumb thing to do, but you have to admit, in this day and age, that constitutes the ultimate in social distancing. Although, from the airport's point of view, not distant enough. Still, we give air traffic control the last word.
Only in LA.
And let's go to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Writer and television producer Nick Santora is back on the show. Last time we had him on was back in 2017 when he was the executive producer of the CBS hit series Scorpion. Well, he's got a few projects in the hopper, but right now there is only one that we can talk about. That's the short-form reboot of The Fugitive starring Kiefer Sutherland that's on Quibi. Nick joins us on the line from California. Hi, Nick.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me.
What led you to a reboot? It's a double-sorted question. What led you to a reboot of The Fugitive, and also, what was the draw of doing something on Quibi that is in short form?
Well, I'll take the second part first, if I can. What led me to Quibi, to be completely honest, was the challenge. It's really, really difficult to tell an entire episode that doesn't feel like a cheat, you know, an entire episode of a story in 7 to 10 minutes. If you cheat and kind of make it about nothing, I guess you could get away with it. But to make an episode that people are engaged with and that people are interested in, it's challenging. And I just wanted to see if I could pull it off. And why The Fugitive, the short answer is they asked me to do it. and I need work. So, of course, I said yes. And The Fugitive is, you know, an iconic title. So, you know, talk about another challenge. That was very enticing to me.
Now, on Quibi, is this, all the episodes put together, is this a beginning, middle, and an end to that particular saga?
Yes, sir. If you put it all together, it will play the goal, the hope, like a really interesting, engaging film. And it'll run like a film will run, with a first act, second act, and third act, and take you on a fun journey, a little bit of escapism, a little bit of fun. And that's the goal. And when it's all said and done, you can take these Quibi series and edit them and turn them into a film. And that's what we're doing. That's what we're going to do with The Fugitive. And that's what we're in the process of doing with Most Dangerous Game, the other Quibi series I did with Christoph Waltz and Liam Hemsworth.
Excellent. So in doing this, are you also, because I know in addition to an executive producer, you're also a writer, as I mentioned in the introduction. Are you writing this as well?
Yes, I write the episodes. I do want to say that with respect to The Fugitive, there was a writer named Albert Torres who had written a movie, a very good movie script. The movie had never been made, but you could fill every, you know, swimming pool in the world with excellent scripts that haven't been made. And Quibi read the script, and they didn't feel parts of the script were right for Quibi, but they felt the concept of a man being accused of a bomb on a subway that he didn't do, wrongfully accused, and then being chased by the authorities, could lend itself to a fugitive type story. And they asked me if I could take Albert Torres's concept and turn it into The Fugitive. So I did write The Fugitive, but I want to be clear, doesn't happen without the great work of Mr. Torres.
I asked the question about the beginning, middle, and end because I got to be honest, from a personal point of view, I love the original movie that Harrison Ford did. I also, but conversely, I'm old enough to remember the original David Janssen television series, and I wasn't the biggest fan, and I'll tell you why. And I know this is also close to your heart in some ways, because I know some of your previous shows kind of deal with this. I've never been a fan of the wrongly accused. In other words, the fact that, David Janssen was looking for the one-armed man literally for 4 years.
I
enjoyed the movie because I knew one way or another it's going to end. But with a television series, you never know what the outcome is going to be if it's a long-running series. So that's why I kind of asked that question. Was it a different muscle for you to write to this form, this short form, as opposed to what you're normally used to writing to?
Yes, it was. It was definitely challenging. I realized that none of these episodes could have filler. They really had to be soup to nuts, beginning to end, nonstop action, nonstop heart, nonstop tension, nonstop emotion. And I also realized as I was going through first Most Dangerous Game and then The Fugitive, which I did afterwards, I honestly realized, Peter, that the process was making me a better writer. It really was. 20 years into my writing career, and I was honing my skill. You know, every day I'm so far from being the best writer in the world. Every day you can learn and every day you can get better. This process really made me get better. And it was such a shock to me because I didn't think this old dog could learn any new tricks at this point in his life, but I did. And it was fun.
You know, I actually was going to ask you that question next, if it honed your skills as a writer, because you had to confine yourself that way.
Yeah, see, I ruined the interview. I jumped the question. But I really did find it honing my skills.
And I have also found that when I go to write other things that aren't in this format, when I go to just write a screenplay, right after I finished work on a project, you know, basically editing and cutting The Fugitive and getting it ready to be aired, I jumped right into writing a very different type of story, a heartfelt, beautiful story about a father and son who walk the Appalachian Trail together looking for the lost family dog. And it's based on a true story, and it's based on this book called Dog Gone, which your listeners should read because it's beautiful. And I wrote that script in 18 days. And the reason I wrote it so quickly is because I was coming off of doing multiple Quibi seasons where you have to be efficient and you can't navel gaze in the storytelling. And I never wrote a feature that fast in my life other than the first feature I ever wrote, because everyone's first feature just flies out of them. So it's really translated to other forms of writing as well, the lessons I've learned from Quibi.
By the way, you're still talking to me, even though I just mentioned earlier about certain types of shows that I don't like. And I'm talking to the
man. That's okay.
I'm talking to the man who did Prison Break.
Well, let me tell you, Prison Break was really hard to do because we had to stretch that taffy so thin that after a while, admittedly, you could see through it. But it was still a blast and lots of fun.
And by the way, I loved Breakout Kings. I love that show that you did. Loved.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's kind of this little show that no one really knows about, but I know everybody affiliated with it really liked it. And I was just talking with the great Malcolm Goodwin the other day, the actor who played Shay on it. And he mentions to me all the time how people always stop him and say they love Prison Break and Breakout Kings. And I'm so thrilled you enjoyed it, because I did too.
Now, how have you been getting through, or did you already just answer that question with the scripts you've been writing? How have you been getting through the COVID situation? Is it easier to be in lockdown when you're a writer?
Well, I would think so. Yeah, I think I'm lucky that I'm a writer because I'm able to, you know, write from home. The problem is because so much production has been shut down, and because the entertainment industry, you know, streamers have done well because people have been at home, but streamers, you're talking about, you know, just a few places that stream that do original content, major studios and major networks and movie theater chains and all of those things have been hit really hard. So production's been shut down. People have been buying less. So I'll be honest, there's a lot of writing and hoping one day someone will buy what you're writing. But my job is to put stupid ideas on paper and hope someone wants to give me some pay for them. I mean, that's how I decided to make my living. So I'm just going to keep writing and keep hoping that you know, COVID ends soon for the sake of everybody.
Well, speaking of putting words down on paper and hoping people will buy them, one of my favorite books of all times was one of yours, 15 Digits. So is there any other writing coming down the pike from you that we can read as opposed to just watch?
Oh, well, first of all, Peter, thank you for saying that. What a great compliment from a guy who absorbs entertainment and pop culture like you do. That compliment means a lot. With respect to, are you asking if I'm writing any more books?
Yes.
Yeah. Not in the near future. It's such an emotional toll to write a book, and you hope people will enjoy it. And especially after when COVID's over, you know, everyone's been such hermits. I'm looking forward to going back on, you know, onto a set or into a writer's room or into a production meeting, even the dreaded budget meetings. I'm just looking forward to being in budget meetings is where I get yelled at for writing stuff that's too expensive. But I'm just looking forward to being around creative people, hardworking people, collaboratively making something together again. And books is so solitary. Even though I do enjoy the process, but I want to, you know,
I want to see my creative friends and get our hands dirty again, hopefully sometime soon.
Because I'd be kind of curious to know somebody who writes creatively for a visual medium who has just admitted that his muscle has tightened and been honed by working for Quibi, how that newfound writing structure would expand itself into a book. How different would a book be from
I would have to say it would probably result in a short book. probably too short.
Well, always a pleasure to have you on the program. The current show is The Fugitive. There are two others in the hopper that we can't talk about, but hopefully when we can talk about them, you'll come back on the show and talk to us about them.
Sir, it would be my pleasure. And please stay safe and healthy in the beautiful city of Montreal.
Nick Santora, executive producer of the short-form reboot of The Fugitive, starring Kiefer Sutherland on Quibi. I know I mentioned Nick's books. He has two, which are really good reads. One is called Slip and Fall, and the other one is called 15 Digits. I've read them both. They're both excellent. But if you've got to pick one, then I'd say 15 Digits. I remember when I read that and I finished the last page, I just sat back and said, whoa. It was the same feeling you get when you've been on a roller coaster for the first time and the ride comes to an end. You have to read that book. And you can go to my website, by the way, at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0577. And you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order both of his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to bizarro cartoonist Dan Ferraro. Plus, Mark Hartzman is in with some weird history. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more in the Stuff File news department on The Stuff File program, which is heard on many stations. It's heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. And you can also find it on several radio stations, such as WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, WLSL LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories, just to name a few. Thanks to all for joining in. Let's get back to the stuff. Detectives with the Tulare County, California Sheriff's Office arrested 23-year-old Bhavna Singh Sekhon of Fresno in late August on suspicion of involvement in an elaborate scheme to steal and sell pistachios to the tune of almost $300,000. Detectives were called to Seton Pistachio on August 14th, where employees reported someone using the name of a legitimate trucking company had picked up two tractor-trailer loads of pistachios but failed to deliver them. They must have left the company shell-shocked. Sheriff's Department spokeswoman Ashley Ritchie said detectives discovered the thieves had also stolen the trailers, which were equipped with GPS that allowed authorities to track them down. Sekhon was charged with grand theft, looting, identity theft, and conspiracy. So, I guess the cops cracked the case.
Wonderful pistachios. Get cracking.
60-year-old Philip DuPaul was summoned to the Cascade County, Montana District Court to serve as a juror. But despite the orders of the governor requiring people to wear masks in public places, and despite Judge John Larson's direct order that DuPaul wear a mask in the courtroom, he refused because he says the COVID scare is exaggerated. The judge offered a face shield instead, but DuPaul refused that too. So Larson ordered him to serve 24 hours in jail for contempt starting immediately. When other inmates found out why he had been jailed, DuPaul says the whole cell block started laughing loudly. At almost the exact same time, Sheriff Jesse Slaughter, and by the way, do you want to have someone in authority named Sheriff Slaughter? Anyway, at almost the exact same time, Sheriff Jesse Slaughter was learning that there was a COVID-19 outbreak in his jail with 55 cases, the worst of any jail or prison in the state. They put me in a position where I could be infected, DePaul whined, and that's wrong. He doesn't see the irony of that comment, does he? Bet he wants his fellow inmates to wear a mask. This also brings me to a deeper, more important question. If you were on trial, would you want a pinhead like old face-uncovered Phil on your jury? Yeah, I didn't think so. And we have time for one more story here on the Stuff File program before we get to our next guest, here with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, full confession time. As someone who has spent the better part of 40 years in a radio studio, most of those working overnight, I have one somewhat irrational fear. That is the psychopathic single woman. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying all single women are psychopathic. It's a very tiny percentage. But the psychopathic single woman actually does exist. Oh, you might say that she's a character of fiction like Alex in Fatal Attraction. And by the way, that's a great movie and a great piece of fiction. On the other hand, I consider Play Misty for Me to be a documentary. But anyway, the psychopathic single woman is out there. And we go to Spain for the most current version of her. A woman who glued up her own vagina in a desperate bid to try to frame her ex for the crime has been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Oh, I need to repeat that sentence. You might not have heard it. A woman who glued up her own vagina in a desperate bid to try to frame her ex for a crime has been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Has that finally sunk in?
Crazy glue bonds almost anything. A plastic knob, a plastic plug, a rubber boot, a metal brooch, a fishing rod, a cycle grip, model planes and model trains, a doorknob screw, a flashlight case, the broken trim on any car.
Vanessa Gesto accused former boyfriend Ivan Rico of kidnapping her outside her home and later abandoning her while semi-naked after squeezing the superglue into her private parts.
Bonds in seconds with amazing strength without clamps, mixing or mess.
Her story began to unravel when investigators uncovered closed-circuit TV footage from a supermarket showing Gesto buying the glue and a kidnap kit, including knives she used to harm herself. Police also discovered the only vehicle filmed passing the spot where she claimed to have been assaulted and then tortured was a city garbage truck, not the black car she said she had been abducted in. The 36-year-old Rico spent several days on remand in prison before the shameful attempts by Gesto, who has been dubbed the glue liar in Spain, became apparent. A court in the northern Spanish city of Leon convicted her to two counts of making up the crime and jailed her for 10 years. She was also ordered to pay her ex 25,000 euros in compensation. Well, let's look at the bright side from Ivan Rico's point of view. At least she only used the crazy glue while she was his ex. Could you imagine what she could have done if they were still together?
Strong enough to hold this man suspended in midair.
Keep that visual in mind. Yes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dan Peraro, the man behind the excellent comic strip Bizarro, is back on the program. He's here to talk about a new project that he's just released. It's a graphic novel called Peyote Cowboy. Dan also has an excellent blog called, aptly enough, Bizarro Blog. He joins us on the line right now from Mexico. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Just doing great. Thank you very much for being on the program with us once again. So I saw the blurb. I subscribe to your blog. So I saw the blurb that came out about your new graphic novel, Peyote Cowboy. This is a long project in the making. It also is a continuing project, right?
Yeah, it really is. I've lived in Mexico for 4 years, and about a year before I left the United States, so that would be about 5 years ago, I got the idea for a scene, just a few scenes at the beginning of a story. And I honestly wasn't trying to think of an idea for a story. It just sort of popped in my head. This guy does this thing, and then this happens. Oh, that's fun. So I wrote it down. And a little while later, some more scenes came to my mind, and I wrote those down, like, days later. And this just kept happening. Even though I wasn't trying to write a story, it just kept writing itself. These things would come to me, and I would write them down. And after a while, I thought, you know, this seems like it could be a graphic novel.
Now, as you mentioned,
and it was it started to fall into my lap, and I followed it, and that was all there was to it.
As you mentioned, you moved to Mexico 4 years ago. Did the environment you live in have anything to do with the inspiration to what you're now creating?
Well, yes and no. Like I say, I started writing the story before I left California. And Southern California is not that different than Mexico, to be honest. So I guess you could say maybe that the Southern California inspiration was something. And then after moving here, yeah, definitely had something to do with it. A lot of the landscape and the characters and the scenes and things sort of come from, because I don't live in a resort. When I tell people I moved to Mexico, they typically imagine a beach town or something, and that's not where I live. I live in the high desert in the center of Mexico, in a small town sort of in the middle of nowhere. The next big city is over an hour from here. So I kind of live out in the wilds of Mexico in a sense. So it's that kind of influence, not at all beach resort community. I think a lot of this stuff falls into it. And then once I got here, at first, you know, we were really involved in just trying to deal with the whole immigrant thing. I mean, you know, we're immigrants. We live in a whole another country where everything is different, and the language is different, and the bureaucracy is different. And, you know, so it takes a while to get settled in. And I kind of put the whole story on the back burner. I started painting. I did a lot of artwork. I had an art show here in Mexico. But then the story came back, and it was like, hey, you know, it was like tapping on the back of my head. Hey, remember me? Go read that story. Read that story you started writing 2 years ago in Pasadena. And I pulled it out and read it, and boom, it caught fire again, and I couldn't stop. And so then I spent months and months just writing and writing and writing. And that's the ongoing part of it, is that I finally finished the writing part, and I know exactly where the story goes and how it ends. But now I'm illustrating it, and it's going to take me probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 years to finish illustrating it. It's a big book, and apparently I'm incapable of doing simple illustrations. All of my art is like incredibly complicated. So, but that's the way I work. So what are you going to do? That's what the book looks like.
So tell us what the story is about, Peyote Cowboy.
Yeah, it starts out, there's the opening scenes. You can see it on peyotecowboy.net. The whole book, as it comes into being, as I finish illustrating it, I'm posting it online week by week, so anybody can read it for free. So the story opens up with a guy racing through the desert on a horse, and a small boy, perhaps of the age of 8 or 10, is clinging to him, hanging on for dear life as they race through the desert landscape. And we don't know who's chasing them or following them or who they're chasing. We don't know why they're doing it. They end up, the horse breaks its leg, they go hide in a cave, then we find out that they're hiding from somebody, but we don't know who, and then the guy, the cowboy, the little boy is really hungry, and so they find a little bit of water in the cave, and then they find that some Indians have hid some stuff in the cave, and so then they eat the stuff, and the guy falls asleep, and when he wakes up, his kid is gone, and this strange skeletal figure is enticing him to come with me and I'll show you where your boy is. And the story is off. This guy's looking for his son. This strange visitor from another dimension is sort of leading him through, and they go into this town and nothing seems right. And it's all very magical realism from there. And that's kind of how it, that's how it kicks off.
So as you mentioned, you've written the whole story. Now you have to illustrate it. So what people can do is they can go to peyotecowboy.net and they can actually read it for free, or and go along with you as you illustrate it?
Yeah, absolutely. You can follow the story as it's getting illustrated. I plan to post one episode each week. An episode will be, you know, 10, 15, 20 images that advance the story enough so that you don't feel like you waited a week for nothing. but that's how I'm proceeding. And yeah, people can follow along at peyotecowboy.net. You can follow the story there, and you can also sign up to just to get a weekly email from me that says, hey, I posted a new episode. Here's the link. Yeah, and then I'm also involved in a website called patreon.com, which is a place where people can donate money if they're enjoying the story. It's not required to read it, but if you enjoy the story and you want to see it continue, you can toss a few bucks at me each month through patreon.com/peyotecowboy.
Very familiar with Patreon.com, which is one of the places that this show is also on. Now,
yes, terrific.
One of the things, just want to clarify, you're going to illustrate this over a period of time, but can people read the full story now?
They cannot.
Okay, so they can only read what you've illustrated so far.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, it's really going to be posted serially. You have to sort of follow it week by week. I mean, at the end, you could always go back, you know, a couple years from now, you can go to peyotecowboy.net and just catch up on see where I am in the story. You know, by then I'll be quite a ways down the road. Who knows? Maybe it'll unfold faster than I think it will. I really don't know. The illustrations are elaborate. The story is big. There's a lot of characters. A lot of things happen. There's double backs. There's twists and turns. So illustrating all of that, it's pretty hard to anticipate or estimate exactly how long it's going to take me to illustrate it. Handful of my friends, two or three, four, I guess maybe like five different colleagues and friends of mine who are writers have read the entire story. I wanted to kind of get some professional sign-off on, yeah, you've done a good job here. There's no loose threads. It's not just a stupid rambling story that came from the mind of someone who thought they were, you know, being creative. I got some good advice from folks before I decided to start illustrating and publishing it. But they're the only ones who have read the full story, besides me.
Now, do you feel any pressure, or do you think you might feel any pressure because you don't know the timetable is how long it's going to take for you to do it? But you know how rabid fans can be and how vocal fans can be. Do you feel any pressure if your fans start to say, you know, hurry up, I'm waiting?
No, I don't. I'm doing the best I can. I've drawn bizarro cartoons daily for 35 years, and I've gotten just about every kind of fan feedback that you can imagine. So I've become fairly accustomed to what it is that people want, what they demand, what they object to, what they like, what they don't like. And I take it all with a grain of salt, you know, and polite and friendly. I'm like, hey, you know, if someone tries to put pressure on me to hurry up, I'll say, look, you want it to be pretty. You want the drawings to look good. So you got to give me time to finish these things. That's just how it goes.
Yeah. Now, last time we spoke, and you touched on it just now, you've had some fine art shows. You have a fine art site. You still have it up, DiegoPeraro.com?
I do, yeah.
And again, what can people find there?
What's that?
And again, what can people find there?
Well, it's my fine art site. I've been doing cartoon illustrations my whole adult life, but I've also on the site been doing other kinds of art that really don't look like cartoons at all. And when I came here to Mexico, when I first semi-retired from Bizarro and started doing fewer than seven cartoons a week, I started painting again. I've been doing it sort of in my spare time for years, but I did enough for an entire show and mounted a show here. And then as soon as that show was over, I got the bug to get back to Peyote Cowboy, and that's kind of what I've been doing since then. But yeah, there's some very interesting, surreal paintings posted on DiegoPeraro.com, and you can buy, actually you can buy the originals, or some of them are for sale, or you can buy really nice art prints from there.
Excellent. Now, again, I read your blog every week, and I know that you can at sometimes delve into politics a little bit in what you write in your blog. So I've got to ask you this. You're now in Mexico, been there for 4 years. Are you going to vote in the upcoming election? And if so, does that mean you're voting by mail?
Absolutely. Yes, we still vote. We're still citizens of the U.S. We're still allowed to vote, and we're voting. Yes, we're voting by mail. So we're fingers crossed. We're hoping that that those votes get counted, but we don't really have any other choice down here. So, but yeah, I'm absolutely still involved in politics in the U.S. And there's a fair amount of like satirical kind of there's some satire in this story. It's from politics, society, religion, a lot of different psychology, a lot of different things are touched on in this book, Peyote Cowboy, that people will recognize as being references to modern things. And in fact, there's even a couple of characters that are somewhat based on the current occupant of the White House.
Okay.
but not in obvious, trashy, easy ways. They're interesting, kind of clever allusions. And what's going on in the world.
And as a reader of a newsletter, I got to ask, what is the origin of jazz pickles?
I've been writing that blog for years, and one day I sat down to write my blog, and just off the top of my head, the first sentence was, "Hey, jazz pickles, how's it going?" And then I went into whatever. And just that expression within one of my blogs turned into a thing. People wrote back and said, "Oh my God, I'm a jazz pickle. I love jazz. What do you know? I love the phrase, blah, blah, blah." So people now identify themselves as jazz pickles, and we have a jazz pickle enamel pin for sale and a bunch of crazy stuff. It just accidentally became the term for a person who follows bizarro comics. They're a jazz pickle. I don't know why.
Well, I guess I'm a jazz pickle. People can go to your blog. People can also look up peyotecowboy.net. They can go to diegopararo.com. So many places you can check out. I thank you once again, Dan, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. Always a pleasure.
Dan Pararo of Bizarro Comics fame. The link to his new graphic novel is peyotecowboy.net. You can also check out his website at bizarro.com, where you can see his work and also sign up for his excellent weekly newsletter. And you can also check out his fine arts site as well, which is diegopararo.com. There you'll find his watercolors, oils, and drawings that you can purchase prints of. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0577, and you'll find all of the links to Dan's pages. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
On the air, on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll share some weird history. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. But I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Also on Spotify and iHeartRadio. Brevard County, Florida sheriff's deputies found evidence of a fresh break-in at a car dealership on Merritt Island before it opened and went to see if the burglar was still there. They found him in the ceiling. They ordered him to come down, and he did, by falling through the ceiling tiles. If that wasn't enough to implicate him, he also had wads of cash falling out of his pants, deputies say. William Kevin Richards allegedly admitted to stealing a lot of money from the safe, but didn't know how much. Deputies counted it. $33,800. Richards, who is already on parole for grand theft, was charged with armed burglary, a pistol he didn't know was loaded, and also grand theft and possession of a weapon by a convicted felon, because they're always convicted felons when they have weapons, aren't they? It seems didn't know is Richard's common refrain. What I'd like to know is why, if you're robbing a place after hours with nobody on the premises, would you need to have a gun? That's what I'd like to know. But I have a feeling we're not getting an answer. So let's just get to our last guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Last month, we talked to Mark Hartzman discussing his latest book, The Big Book of Mars, From Ancient Egypt to the Martian, a deep space dive into our obsession with the Red Planet. Well, Mark also has a great website called weirdhistorian.com, which is a fun read. So I thought each month we'd bring Mark back to feature a weird moment in history for the current month. And he joins us once again via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Now, I know there's a big election going on in your country, and there's a lot of straw polls taking place right now, and your story deals with straw, but not of the polling or political kind.
A very different kind, a less upsetting kind.
Well, no, I've read the story. I'm sure at the time it was upsetting for some people.
That's true. It was a bit of a disturbing scene, I guess, about 98 years ago.
So tell us the story.
So this was happening in September of 1922 in New York City. It was known as the Straw Hat Riots. And this happened because people wore straw hats all summer. This was the fashion for men. They were nice, perfect for summer hats. They were light. They were airy. But after September 15th, it was a fashion faux pas. You weren't supposed to wear your straw hat anymore. You had to switch over to your felt hat. You know, men wore hats all day, every day, for anything. So they had to switch their hats over, though. And if they didn't, kids would just swipe them off your hat, off your head, and smash your hat. And this was just a thing that would happen. So this night of September 16th, it was reported that a whole bunch of these kids in New York City, they would hide like between the doorways, and they would have sticks with hooks on them at the end, and they'd snatch hats right off the heads of people walking by wearing their hat, because it was past that September 15th deadline. And they would just start stomping on them. They would put them in piles and hold bonfires in the streets. And it was just complete hooliganism running rampant through the city. And this was like thousands of people's hats were just being taken and stomped on. And so this was going on throughout all the streets, and people were getting arrested. Fights were happening. The police stations were having parents come down to pick up their kids, like dozens and dozens of kids who were getting arrested. And they were all fined $5 because even though this was a tradition, to smash a hat was considered illegal. And one of the judges got very upset about the whole thing. The judge's name, coincidentally, was named Mr. Hadding, Peter Hadding. And he was getting upset about the whole thing. He said, look, he knows it's a tradition, but he said it's against the law to smash a man's hat. And he has a right to wear his hat in a January snowstorm if he wants to. And to hit a man's hat is a simple assault. And in this court, it would be treated as such. And he wanted them to spread the word that anyone who would smash a hat would be in trouble. And he might even skip the fine and just arrest them and put them in jail. So this was a pretty big deal, upsetting a lot of people at the time.
Now, you say the judge mentioned it was a tradition. Do we know from when this tradition started? Like how I'm assuming the climax to this was in 1922 when it built to the point where a judge said enough is enough. But do we know how long this had been going on every September?
I'm not sure how long it was going on, but definitely just a September tradition, I guess, as long as these hats were in fashion, which was probably a little, for, you know, probably a few decades at that point. I know by the 1930s, the fashion kind of changed and straw hats sort of fell away. And so the tradition fell away with it. But it's weird because, you know, you hear about different kinds of weird fashion faux pas, but they're never so violent. You know, there's usually not a tradition of smashing and destroying a fashion. It might just be a look or a comment at the worst. But violence usually isn't part of it.
It's interesting because, you know, we often say you're not supposed to wear white after Labor Day. And I'm wondering if that goes back to this time as well. It seems like you have a whole series of things in the week between Labor Day and now the 15th or the 16th of September where you have to change your wardrobe over.
Yeah, I mean, the change of season seems very demanding. You know, the whole don't wear white after Labor Day also seems a little strange. But again, you know, strange as it is, at least it wasn't so so brutal. And maybe it was sort of a soft revolution of the straw hats and that tradition.
I'm thinking that if you can't wear white after Labor Day and you can't wear straw hats after the 15th, that barbershop quartets have to go into hiding.
Yeah, I mean, that may have had to be more of a summertime tradition. Maybe the winter barbershop quartet was a whole different thing. Or maybe it was just, you know, indoors in a contained environment where you couldn't have the hooligans with their sticks and hooks trying to, you know, take it off your head and smash it. At least not till after the song was done.
It's also, it also seems like you mentioned that this is something that had been going on for quite a few years. So it's quite possible that some of the people who were having their hats snatched in 1922 may have participated in the same situation, you know, 10, 20 years earlier.
That's true. So they may have just been a little bit used to it. I think in this case, you know, I think the weather was just still kind of nice so that they weren't ready to switch over yet. And so just they kept wearing the hats despite the deadline. And then it didn't go over well when everyone's trying to smash them.
I guess it's the same thing we deal with, you know, every year at Halloween when there's mat night or people egging doors. We've all seen it. We've all witnessed it. We've all, in some cases, may have even participated in it in our youth. But as adults, we think, oh, this has gone too far.
Yeah, I think that's a good example. In this case, I think it was just too many all at once and going too far. I mean, there's a picture I have on the website with the article. And I mean, you just see this is just a picture of men wearing white straw hats in general. And I mean, it's just thousands of white hats in the street. I mean, everyone had them. So to imagine this mass of people having their hats swiped off and then the smashing and the burning, I mean, it is a pretty ridiculous scene. You could see how it would be a little upsetting to people and how the riot could just kind of spin out of control.
You know, nowadays, in this world that we live in, where everyone believes in conspiracy theories of one kind or another, I'm sure some people would be pointing towards maybe this was a major plot by the straw hat makers.
or the felt hat makers.
Or the felt hat makers.
Yeah, I think that that the felt hat stores actually, you know, did well during this time because everyone had to go open. They had to stay open a little bit later and allow people more time to come replace their hats. So yeah, it could be, that could be an interesting thought that maybe they were promoting it the whole time, kind of behind, you know, behind the scenes.
And you mentioned that the judge, and again, what a great name, Magistrate Peter A. Hadding, you mentioned he charged, that the fine was $5. That seems kind of steep for 1922.
That is. I mean, that's a good deal of money. I mean, I don't have the translation off the top of my head, but $5 back then was a good amount of money. So those kids who were getting $5 fines, I'm sure they were getting a lot more trouble at home.
Now, you can read stories like these and others on weirdhistorian.com. I marvel, by the way, at the fact, I don't know if it's because it's the time period you were talking about, but the fact that you could use the word rapscallion in your story warms my heart.
It felt fitting for the time, right? And the subject matter.
It really did. I thank you once again, Mark, for being on the program. I look forward to talking to you next month to find out what we're going to discuss about October. How do you go about searching out for the... what catches your eye when you're looking for weird history?
Well, in general, I think this story, first of all, I heard something about, and when I heard that, I thought, wow, this sounds crazy. So I had to look it up and start digging into some old articles from newspaper archives. But, you know, sometimes it's just different things I come across, and I kind of dig into it and try to learn more about it. And you start to uncover all these weird things, or one thing leads to another, which is how a lot of my projects have gone. The Mars book, for example, was one of those where one story led me to another story, and you know, you just kind of go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, looking through old newspaper archives is a lot of fun. I mean, there's just a lot of weird stories that you find out about. Type in weird keywords and see what comes up and go from there. So it's kind of fun. I mean, sometimes I think the stories just tend to find me as well.
Meanwhile, I don't know about where you are right now, but where we are here in Montreal, it is still warm enough for a straw hat.
Here too. Okay. Hope not too much longer. Be careful.
Mark, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0577, and you'll find links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Butler County, Ohio sheriff's deputy was driving in his marked patrol car heading to the office when he noticed the vehicle behind him was matching all of his turns. Sergeant Mike Matala noticed a few infractions by the driver, and after 11 miles of tailing him from the city of Trenton to the county seat of Hamilton, he turned into a parking lot, swung around behind the suspicious vehicle, ran its license plate, and pulled it over. The vehicle was reported as stolen. Matala asked Christina King why she was following him. She just wanted to see where he was going, she said. Well, I guess the answer is to jail. Because why, oh why, would you tail a marked police car for 11 miles while you're driving a stolen vehicle? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0577. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0577. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.